So have you ever been on a nature walk? You know, you wake up feeling a little bit Brady, and you're like, "Hey, I think I'll go for a walk outside now." You know, you're just ready to go. "I'm just gonna go outside. I'm gonna go have fun." Well, there's all kinds of research out there that says walking outside in nature is good for you in lots of different ways. Some of the ways that's been marked out is it can improve things like your memory. It can improve your heart health. It can improve your circulation. Not only does it improve, it can also, according to research, possibly lower your cholesterol, lower your glucose levels, lower your blood pressure, and it can also reduce things like inflammation and stress and anxiety and depression. At least that's what the research says. And the National Park Service says that the natural aromas from wood and plants and things out in nature, it has a calming effect. And that even viewing nature is just good for mental fatigue. Now, of course, that doesn't apply right now, because if you go outside right now, there is the fatigue, as one group of chromatic scientists said. You walk in and you walk out, walk back in, and you say, "You know what? It's all yellow. It's just all yellow," you know? But pollen aside, there is not much room to disagree with the fact that a walk in nature does have something. It does something to us. But what if there was a nature walk that did more than just create some healthy benefits? What if there was a nature walk that changed how you live and changed how you die? A nature walk that actually impacts every part of your existence. We continue our series called Who Are You? And what we're trying to do is to individually look at our lives in such a way that we embrace a healthy sense of conviction, and we also build up a great deal of confidence through defining who we are. And we're letting the Apostle Paul help us out with that. And today, what we're going to do is take a little walk outside to try to see who we are. And really, it's not just a walk outside, it's a walk inside our heart and our mind and our spirit, the deepest part of who we are. And Paul wrote a letter to some folks in an ancient city called Ephesus. And it's not ancient what he has to say. In fact, what he has to say is desperately needed for every one of us right now. Our message today is called It's a Question of Nature. And we're going to see what Paul has for us beginning in Ephesians 2, verse 2. "In which you previously walked according to the course of this world." Now, Paul's continuing the thought that he just laid out in the sentence before that. And what he laid out was that there is a difference between being a Christian and being a non-Christian. And it's not a difficult difference. It's a simple difference. It's a plain difference. And it's not just that one person goes to church and the other person doesn't go to church. And it's not just that one person is, you know, religiously fundamental and the other person is relatively fun. No, this picture that Paul is giving is that a believer and a follower of Jesus is spiritually alive, and someone who does not believe and follow Jesus is spiritually dead. This is how he said it in verse 1, "And you were dead in your offenses and your sins." Spiritually dead, meaning separated from the direct spirit and atmosphere and influence of all that is perfectly good, perfectly happy, perfectly holy, and perfectly satisfying. Now, someone may ask, "Well, why dead? I mean, why do you have to use that language? Why couldn't he just say, you know, not as religious, you know, or not as spiritual?" Well, there may be a lot of reasons for why he used the language. Here's just one, and that is this: death impacts every single aspect of your existence, right? I mean, Paul would use a word like dead because he was really wanting to make this clear. Death impacts every part of who we are. It impacts our entire existence. Unlike Miracle Max and the Kingdom of Florin, none of us are mostly dead when it comes to dead. Death is real. A person is either spiritually alive or they're spiritually dead. And spiritual death means that we are completely cut off, helpless, and powerless. We're not able in our heart and our mind and our spirit to have anything of ultimate and eternal value. And Paul's writing these mostly new Christians in Ephesus, and the reason he's writing with this kind of language is he wants them to remember what they've been convicted of, the conviction of sin, the conviction of their need from God, but he also wants to build their confidence. And the way he does it is by saying this, hey, remember when you were dead. Now, I've spent my life in the Southern Baptist Church, and I will just say, over the last 52 years, it seems we don't like being told that. But guess what? It ain't just Southern Baptists. It's all the other denominations, and it's every human being. We don't like being told we're dead in sin. What we want to hear is, I'm a good worker. I make a good cobbler. My family likes me. I work hard. My yard looks good. I'm great with money. I care, put people through college. I do all the things. And yes, religion is a good part. No, you're dead in sin. I'm dead in sin. Paul's best shot at building their confidence is to say, you were dead. That's how you previously walked. What about you? When it comes to the question of who are you, how do you deal with this part of that question? Because see, in asking who are you, part of the most demanding and defining parts of that is coming to grips with this. Are you dead in your sins, or is that how you previously walked? Because if it's how you previously walked, it makes all the difference in the world. Someone once said that life in general, that every one of our lives, life is like a walk. It's an active process, step by step, right? We're walking through life. So how are you walking? How are you stepping? When we look at the very nature of what Paul's writing about, when it comes to your day-by-day, step-by-step, active process of life, are you walking in such a way, are your steps in such a way that they are more defined by the glory of God, or are they more defined by the glory of yourself? When it comes to the day-by-day, step-by-step, active process of your life, is it more of a sinful nature walk, or is it more of a spiritual nature walk? What's your normal nature? Like the deepest part of how you think, how you reason, how you plan, how you spend money, how you spend the weekends, how you work, how you act, how you talk. What's your normal nature? What's the normal nature that people that you work with or go to school with or go to church with or live in the same home with or text with or talk on the phone with or play golf with or hunt with or shop with or whatever it is that you do with other people, what would be the normal nature that most people see in you? Who are you? Is your normal nature sinful, or is your normal nature spiritual? Now, someone may say, well, I mean, aren't we all sinners? I mean, don't we all have a sinful nature? Yes, we do. We all, every single one of us, if we're given the option, we're going to be prone to wander more toward sin than holiness. But there is a distinct difference between being on a sinful nature walk and being on a spiritual nature walk. There's a distinct difference in the very nature of our nature. And what is that difference? Well, I shared the same thought last week, and I just, it's had such an impact on my mind that I think it's appropriate for us to hear it again. One commentator put it this way: to be dead to sin does not mean that a believer is totally unable to sin. We know how to sin, right? He goes on. It means that Christ has separated him from the slavery of sin and set him apart for a specific purpose. So having a spiritual nature walk doesn't mean we don't sin. We all sin. But having a spiritual nature walk just means you are no longer a slave to sin. That you've been rescued from being a slave to sin. So have you been rescued like that? And how can you know? Well, Paul's trying to help us here. He's given us a lot of things to think through. First, he says that the sinful nature walk is marked with being obsessed with the course of this world. What is the course of this world? Well, simply put, it's the systems of the world. The system or systems, however you want to say it. And in one sense, that means the systems of the world that have always been around, from the garden until now. The system of the world that looks at creation, sees the majesty and the beauty and the power and the authority of God, and they know inside of their heart and their mind and their spirit that this is something beyond them and that there's no way this just happened. But that system still says, nah. They just dismiss God. They deny the very existence of God. So in one sense, the course of this world is the system that's always been there. Hey, believe in yourself, don't believe in God. Believe in science, don't believe in God. Believe in nature, don't believe in God. Believe in sports, don't believe in God. Whatever it is. But it dismisses God. But in another sense, the course of this world is 2025. You know, it's the politics and the fashions and the finances. It's all the philosophies and idiosyncrasies of how we live right now, the things that make up life right now. And what fuels this course of the world? Paul tells us next, verse 2, according to the prince of the power of the air. The course of this world is fueled according to the prince of the power of the air. Well, who's the prince of the power of the air? Well, very simply, it is the enemy of all enemies, the greatest enemy of your soul, Satan, the devil. Now, someone may say, dude, come on, it's 2025. Really? The devil? Some little guy with, you know, red pointy ears and horns and a tail. Really? I mean, you really believe in the devil? I have often referenced the words of a late justice of the Supreme Court. They were being interviewed one time, and the question turned to something about the evil that is in the world. And this was the justice's response and saying something about that. And I'll just say this, that in the interview, the interviewer was kind of shocked and offended even that this was his answer. But this is what he said. Most of mankind has believed in the devil for all of history. Many more intelligent people than you or I have believed in the devil. In a similar way, C.S. Lewis once said that the disciples had it a little easier than preachers today, because back in that time, from the time of Jesus all the way back, there was some acknowledgement and understanding by all people, hey, we're probably not that good. But in modern times, we're convinced we are that good, and we may or may not need God. Likewise, we live in a time where many will say, oh, well, gosh, this devil stuff, that's ridiculous. But it's kind of particular to us, because throughout history, there's been an acknowledgement of the enemy. But maybe take it from another angle. Think about all the different things that we see in life. Things like pride and greed and jealousy and violence and injustice. Where do those things come from? I mean, do they really just come from too much caffeine? Or not enough caffeine? Do those things really come from playing video games too much? Do they really come from too much talk radio or from too many twists in the genetic code? Or in our heart of hearts, do we know that there's something underneath everything else? The Bible describes the devil like this. He tempts people to sin. He blinds people from truth. He takes people captive to fear. And he attacks people's faith. And that's just an overview. There's so much more. Jesus believed in the devil and consistently spoke of his influence in the course of this world. I've also often referenced the words of C.S. Lewis in Screwtape Letters when he said this: there are two equal and opposite errors into which our race can fall about the devils. One is to disbelieve in their existence. The other is to believe and to feel an excessive and unhealthy interest in them. So what we need to do is desperately avoid both of those errors. Not to blow off the devil and his agents and go, that's a bunch of, you know, religious fairy tale, hokey pokey stuff. Nah, that's not true. And the other side is to believe in the devil and his agents so much that you think they're more powerful than Jesus. That you think they have more power in this universe than they do. Don't go to either extreme. The extreme that we need to go to is really simple. Just simply acknowledging the existence of the prince of the power of air and his influence and his investment, for lack of a better word, in the course of this world and the systems of this world, past, present, and future. And why does Paul refer to the devil as the prince of the power of the air? Why would he use that kind of language? You know, again, he's already said, well, we're dead in our sins. Now he's using this language, prince, the power of the air. What is he saying? Well, he's saying, in a sense, that this is some sobering imagery reminding us that just like air can get just about anywhere, his influence can get just about anywhere. And Paul expands on that imagery. Next part of verse 2. Of the spirit that is now working in the sons of disobedience. This word working here, it means energizing. So Paul's painting this picture that the devil is not just trying to distract you on Sunday morning. He's not just trying to discourage you during the week. The language is he is energizing disobedience in the course of this world. He is putting energy, fueling an atmosphere of sin and defiance and rebellion and selfishness and wickedness and everything else. He's energizing the sinful nature walk. So again, we ask, who are you? Are you on a sinful nature walk, or are you on a spiritual nature walk? Are you walking in accordance with the course of this world, or are you walking in accordance with the character of God? Now look, none of us are perfect, okay? I would love to tell you that when I got in my car this morning and cranked it and it didn't crank, I went, well, praise Jesus, I just love everything about my life. No, my first thought was the only car close enough to jump me off was my son's, and I had no idea where his key was, and everybody was asleep. I was like, man, I ain't never gonna find that key. So look, none of us are perfect. But again, generally speaking, is the active process of your life, the day by day, step by step, the way you think and act and live, generally speaking, is it fueled more by the course of this world, by the systems of this world, are more by the character of God? Well, how can you tell? Well, again, Paul's going to give us some things to help us. Look at verse 3. Among them, we too all previously lived in the lust of our flesh, indulging the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, just as the rest. None of us are perfect, but what are the ultimate desires of our flesh and our mind? Is the primary nature of our walk, the active process of life, is it sinful or is it spiritual? It seems like Paul is telling us the best way we can answer that question is by determining whether or not we're like the rest. What does that mean? Well, what he's saying is this: are you redeemed and saved and rescued by God? So has the extraordinary work of God happened in your life? Or are you like the rest? Are you just an ordinary man or woman or boy or girl? Who are you? Ordinary or extraordinary? Jeff Thomas says this: your sense of humor and your values and your enthusiasms and your evenings and your weekends are just the same as the in crowd you belong to. In other words, he's saying you can look, it doesn't take long to figure out whether you're a course of the world or a character of God. He goes on, you follow the ways of this world. You have the same prejudices about Jesus Christ, and you covet and lust and ache for the same experiences. You dream the same dreams. You worry the same worries. You are distracted by the same cares. You refuse to consider the same great realities of death, judgment, eternity, and God. You are just like the world. How are we day by day, step by step in life? Do we dream the same dreams, worry the same worries? Are we distracted by the same cares? Do we consider the great realities of death, judgment, and eternity, and God just like, not that big a deal? Now, this doesn't mean that enjoying things in the world automatically means you're on a sinful nature walk. Okay, that's not what we're talking about, you know? It's good to enjoy a good restaurant. It's great to enjoy some hot dogs from a gas station, you know? I mean, it's good. There's things in life it's okay to enjoy, all right? It's okay to go on vacation. So it's okay to buy a car. It's okay. But the picture here is pretty clear. What's fueling who you are? Jeff Thomas goes on to say this. What Paul's saying to us is that the most appalling thing you can say about a person is that he's just an ordinary guy or an ordinary girl. In other words, that you're just like the rest. So, are you ordinary or extraordinary? Have you repented of your sin, turned to Jesus, received this extraordinary salvation that is only found in him? This extraordinary salvation that he suffered and bled and died to purchase for you? Or are you ordinary? Is there nothing extraordinary about your spirit because it has never made a connection with the one true living God through Jesus? And remember, ordinary sounds like an ordinary word, but Paul is not talking about just ordinary here. He says that the ordinary folks, the folks that are just as the rest, he says they're children of wrath. The word for wrath here means that something is swelling. It's just always swelling, always swelling, always swelling. And it will burst. It's the very nature of what it is. And so Paul's saying that the sinful nature walk is always swelling. It's always swelling. And it can't help but eventually burst into separation from God forever. There's no other way for it to work. But it doesn't have to be that way. It doesn't. That's why Paul's writing. It doesn't have to be that way. There is a way for your life to swell with anticipation. Swell with anticipation that doesn't lead to separation, but it leads to joy. How? By becoming a different kind of child. By becoming a child of God. Paul's writing to try to help them see, look, you once were a child of wrath, but now you're a child of God. Well, how does that happen? How do you become a child of God? Well, Jesus said you must be born again. All right? Well, how do you be born again? That's what Nicodemus said to Jesus. What are you talking about? How can I go back into my mother's womb? Well, again, Jesus, in the simplest of terms, said that the way to be a child of God, the way to be born again, is to repent and believe. Well, how does that work? I don't know. It is a mystery and it is a miracle, and there is no greater mystery and no greater miracle than that. The mystery and the miracle that God quickens our spirit to life. And when our spirit is quickened to life, we believe. And then somehow, as we believe, we're adopted into the family of God, and we are permitted to receive the inheritance that only belongs to the children of God. How does that happen? What is this inheritance? Well, it's a mystery how it happens. It's a miracle how it happens. If you're saved, it's not because you prayed a sinner's prayer. If you're saved, it's because God created a miracle in your soul. You once were dead, but now you're alive. That is astounding. That is overwhelming, and it should create a sense of anticipation and joy. If we've been rescued from death, what can man do to us? But what is this inheritance? Some of y'all a couple of weeks ago met my friend Brent Martin, who preached for me, and some of you may have even met his oldest child, his daughter Tess. A few weeks after Brent and Marion adopted Tess, Brent was preaching at our church, and he said this: "You don't earn adoption. Tess was chosen. She wasn't looking for us. We were looking for her. And the first second my eyes met hers, she had status. It was instant. She was a Martin. Everything I had or would ever have was now hers because she was now mine. In the seconds before I saw her, I had never known her. And the moment I did see her, she had everything that would ever be mine." And then he said this, I'll never forget it. He said, "This is what God does. We get the family name and all that he owns." What is the inheritance of a child of God? What is the inheritance of someone who's on a spiritual nature walk? Everything. All of it. God's name, his family, all of it is ours. Our inheritance is him. So when it comes to your nature, when it comes to your inheritance, when it comes to the difference of being extraordinary and ordinary, who are you?